You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week I will bring guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Now, I will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And I'll continue to bring you these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our topic today is the marvelous learning animal. What makes human nature unique? Our guest today, Dr. Arthur W. Stotz, is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Psychology at the University of Hawaii at Moana. He is internationally known as an innovator and is the inventor of Time Out for the use with children and the token reward system, also known as the token economy. In 2006, Child Magazine recognized him as one of the 20 people who changed childhood. He is the author of 6 books, more than 50 chapters, and over 8 journal articles, among other publications. Recent publications include Behavior and Personality, Psychological Behaviorism. Another is The Psychological Behaviorism Theory of Personality, which is a framework of the 21st century, and Psychological Behaviorism and Behaviorism Psychology, the Behavior Analyst, and his latest book, The Marvelous Learning Animal. Arthur, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Well, it is great to have you here. I
make one correction.
Please.
It's 7 books, not 6.
it's 7 books. Well, see, yeah. you're cranking them out so fast, we can't keep up with you. So, anyway, I've had a chance to go through the book, and you make some very interesting points, where a lot of people right now are out there suggesting that so much of who we are is genetic, and you have some disagreement in that area. So share with us a little bit about the book and what makes us human.
Well, actually, that is a very important part. There's a very deep-seated belief in our society and all societies, really, that what we are, the way we as adults are and the way we become as children, depends upon what's wired inside of our brains and, you know, what's built within us. And a large part of the information that we have about human behavior assumes that it is caused from within. There really isn't good evidence of that. That's largely assumption. And we could go over many of the points and indicate that, but at this point I'll just leave it at that. Much of what we think comes from wired in mechanisms really is learned. It's learned from experience. And we all know that. Parents know that. That the way the child has experiences will have a heavy effect upon the child. But even though we know that, we don't know specifically how that works. And therefore, there's a large assumption that the causation comes from within.
Well, share with us some examples. I know with some of the families that we've worked with, I've gotten the question from them that have said, we don't understand. We've raised three children. The first one, went off to Harvard to go to medical school, and the second one went off to Yale to go to law school, and the third one, we can't seem to get him to get out of bed. Share with us a little bit about some of the research that, because again, we get these questions, and I know that the parents that listen, sometimes they're real puzzled. Is there more that they can do? How much of it is the changes in society? What are the things that parents can do to stack the deck in their favor when they're raising children?
Actually, that's a very good question, because it's one of the things that make people assume that there must be something different within that child who is different from the other two siblings. Uh-huh. Here you have two siblings, high-achieving siblings, and then you have this low achiever. So the assumption is it must be something within that child. But, within the same family, conditions can be different, quite different, for the different children in there. And what really does happen is something may start out in a certain way at a low level. The child may be, the younger child in this particular case, may be what we call being babied, may be spoiled a little bit, may not be expected to achieve as much as the others. And that may start out in an unnoticeable way, but what happens in human life is that things start out, but then they grow. A child learns certain things, and that leads the child to learn other things. And that leads the child to learn other things. And what takes place is imperceptible to those who are right there in the family, but nevertheless grow from small beginnings into a general characteristic of the child.
Now, I mean, how much of this can be just, a way in which, let's say in the scenario I gave, the third child, going on the basis that we all have a desire for significance, we all have a desire for attention, is that one of those situations to where, based on what the other two did, the way that this child gets attention is the way in which they've chosen, which might be, again, doing nothing, which draws a lot of attention to them by the parents to try to motivate them, or the child that acts out, which again draws attention to them or makes them significant, even if it's in a negative way.
I think that's a very good analysis that you've made, and that's the type of thing that happens.
Okay. Now, within the book, I know that one of the areas that you start in is you talk about the paradigms and the fallacies of science. Share with us some of the paradigms that you believe and some of the things that you think are fallacies that maybe we've been led to believe.
Well, one that's very important in science and has had a great effect begins with Darwin, Darwin studied physical features, for example, like finches in the Galapagos. The finches in one island are subjected to certain kinds of feeding possibilities, developed beaks of a certain sort. On another island close by, where the feeding is different, they develop different kinds of beaks. So he studied how evolution takes place by the species adjustment, adaptation to the environment. And that's called natural selection. Well, that's really a genetic change.
Right.
But now what Darwin did was he assumed that behavior is also that way. That, for example, Some people are more intelligent than others. Some groups of people are more, show more intelligence than others. And he assumed that the same kind of genetic adaptation was responsible for that. But he didn't have any, he actually didn't study that. He had no evidence on which to base that. So you see, that was a wrong turn, and it influenced beliefs about human behavior. Since it has influenced them since that time. That's one.
Okay.
I can give you another one if you'd
sure,
like.
Sure, I would love it.
In recent times, technology has developed ways of observing, measuring the brain, both in its shape and in its function. And so a number of studies have been done where a group of subjects, like autistic children. Mm-hmm. So autistic children, their brains will be measured and tested, and a group of normal children will be measured and tested, and they see differences in the brains of the two. And so the assumption then is that it is the brain difference that accounts for autism. But you see, that's making a jump there that's not really possible. And that is, the fact of the matter is, the child's experience, people's experience, affects the shape and the function of their brain. So if the autistic children have had different experiences, the reason their brains are different than normal children is because, because they've had different experiences. And it's obvious, it's certainly obvious that an autistic child has different experiences than normal children. So their brain should be different on the basis of learning, on the basis of their experience. That's an error that is very common today in our society and amongst scientists.
Okay, and now while we're talking about the brain, a question that I've always wondered, because I've heard differing percentages. What percentage of the brain, you know, do we as humans now use, and what do you believe is the capacity that we could reach?
Well, I certainly would suggest this. I can't really answer your question by providing evidence, but I can tell you what I think about that.
I would love to know what you think.
Yeah. The human brain is a huge, huge instrument, and it is capable of the most complex learning. I mean, just learning language, which all humans are able to do. Just learning language involves like 80,000 words, and it involves all kinds of complex combinations and complex grammatical rules. We don't really realize it, but the fact that humans have that language, a brain that can learn like that, is absolutely fantastic. And that's that indicates the amount of learning that humans can go through.
Okay.
Does that sort of indicate?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's just I've heard different different percentages and such, and then I've also because of the reference that you have towards us being sort of a marvelous learning animal,
yes.
Where I've had people have said that there are certain animal instincts that we as humans that we had many, many generations ago that because we no longer need, we no longer use. So I was kind of leading up into an area with the brain of, whatever we use, we continue to grow from, and whatever we don't use, we lose. So I was just kind of wondering, is that sort of an accurate theory?
Let me indicate something that I think will respond to your question in what I've been dealing with, and that is this. You know, humans not only have a huge brain capable of very complex learning, but humans have a kind of learning that no other animal has. And that is, humans learn complex repertoires, like language, mm-hmm. like arithmetic, like being an NFL quarterback, like being a brain surgeon, and like being a music composer and loving music. Those are very, very complex repertoires. But now, what's important is those repertoires enable humans to learn other things. And when they learn other, for example, a child learns language. Because a child has learned language, a child can learn to read. Because a child can, that reading repertoire allows the child to learn literature, mathematics, history, science of different kinds. Humans have this building quality of learning one repertoire, which enables them to learn another and another, until human learning is, in essence, infinite in those possibilities. And there are also other things that make it infinite. Does that sort of answer your question?
Yes, yes, it does, because that's kind of where I was going at. And you touched on child development. And I know you also touch on it in your book.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about, child development and sort of that missing link.
Okay, I'll do that because that happens to be one of the areas that's been closest to my heart, and I've done many studies with children. And something that may be of interest, I raised our own children according to the things that I had already established in my research. So when my daughter was born in 1960, I began working with her and doing things that enabled her to learn things, that enabled her to learn other things. Let me indicate to you, there are parents whose children don't speak as early as other children do.
Uh-huh.
In fact, yes?
Yeah, go ahead.
And I can tell, because of my understanding of learning, I can tell the parents what they should do if they want their children to speak in good time, and or if the child doesn't already speak, what they can do. And some of it is very, very simple.
Now, is this the area in your book where you refer to it as generating first language development?
Yes, that's
yes.
Exactly it. Yes.
Please share with us about that. I was very interested in that.
Okay. You know, one of the things that happens in child development is about 6 months of age or around there, a child will begin to babble, and that is to say syllables that are like those in the parent's language, but they're not words yet. So the child may say da 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 da, ma 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 ma, or ba 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 ba. The child that's babbling,
mm-hmm.
and so, but that is a crucial development. Not all children will develop that at 6 months. Some will not babble at a year of age. That's not good, because that's on the way to having language.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for a parent, if a parent had a child who didn't babble at 6 months, 7 months, 8 months of age, I could tell the parent what to do.
Okay.
And that is, do positive things with a child and talk. For example, there are parents who will have a child and the child sits in a high chair. The parent will put the food on the tray and then go off and do something else. What the parent really wants to do is to sit there with the child while the child is eating, facing the child, and talking to the child.
Now, how much of that at an early stage is mimicking, and how much of that is them starting to understand?
Actually, I would say what's happening there is if the parent is feeding the child and talking to the child will learn to love the parent's voice. That's what happens. What happens is the child will have a positive emotional response to the parent's voice. And what that really means is if the child happens to say something that sounds like the parent, that'll be very rewarding for the child, and the child will learn to do that. That's how the child learns to babble. You know, a child who's raised by Chinese-speaking parents learns to babble Chinese sounds. Mm-hmm. A child who's raised in with Hungarian parents learns to babble Hungarian sounds. And they do that because those sounds, through their experience, through their learning, become very positive emotionally. And so that's what the parent wants to do, is to make his voice, her voice, positive emotionally for the child.
Okay, so just to interject, so in other words, those parents that are constantly putting their child in the high chair and setting him in front of a television while they go off to do 10 other things, their child's going to get a positive response towards the voice on the television, but not the parent? That's why we have so many people watching television.
Yes, absolutely, exactly. And I should say, a lot of parents, I've seen parents do this, they'll just have the child sitting there in silence. That's wasted. See, that's wasted experience. Rather than the child learning to love the parent's language, the child's learning nothing.
Now, how about now when the child is entering school, what is one of the best predictors of whether or not he or she will learn to read or end up with dyslexia or something like that?
Yes, well, one of the best predictors of whether the child will learn to read is whether the child knows the letters of the alphabet, whether the child can read the letters of the alphabet or some of the letters of the alphabet. And again, that's something that a parent can very straightforwardly impart to their child.
Sure. Now, about what age is a good time for parents to have to start working with them, to learn the alphabet either by saying it or with flashcards or a combination of the two?
Yes. You know, one of the things that a parent should know, and that is in doing things like training the child, let's say to the alphabet, it's important that the child find it to be rewarding. In other words, the parent of the child should be doing it voluntarily. Mm-hmm. And so the parent really needs some kind of a reward system to maintain this activity. When the child doesn't want to participate anymore, it shouldn't go on, because that will be aversive or punishing for the child. So one of the early studies that I did was with 4-year-old children, culturally deprived children, and presented them with a alphabet learning task. And so under one condition, they were rewarded for doing that. They got small trinkets and edibles like raisins and peanuts, a raisin or a peanut, when they responded. Well, under that condition where they were rewarded, they were very attentive. They paid attention. They said the things that the instructor indicated, like the names of the letters of the alphabet, and they learned well. Okay. But when there was no reward, they didn't. They fooled around. They didn't want to participate. And actually, they requested not to do it anymore, at which point it was changed again to a rewarding condition, and then they participated voluntarily and happily.
Now, is that part of your reading game, the one that you have that's sort of a preventative measure to dyslexia?
Indeed, that is. What I called it with my daughter was the reading game. And we would play the reading game only for about 5 minutes, not very long. What it involved was her seeing pictures and naming them, or seeing a letter and then being told what it was, and then she would say it and she would learn the letters that way. But after this few minutes, we would have dessert. That was the reward. Mm-hmm. And she participated happily and voluntarily. Now, one of the things you want to do is see to it that the child doesn't make any errors, because if they make errors, then it becomes confusing. So the parent shouldn't hesitate to prompt the child, to tell the child the what the right answer is, so that no errors are made. The child is always successful. The child is rewarded afterwards. It's a happy family get-together. That was the reading game with my daughter.
Yeah, and I think that's beautiful. And I've got a question and a comment. The comment is that I love the fact that it's very positive. You're focusing on the strengths. You're focusing on the positives. And I think that makes it sort of a beautiful game to begin with. Now, my question is that, now jumping forward, you said you did this with your daughter. Did she become one of those people that loves to read?
She did.
She did.
She did. And then that's actually what happened with the child. Because, you know, after we finished with the alphabet, then we went into words. Then we went into short stories, into longer stories, and so it was the reading game actually went on for years, and until a point came when she wanted to read on her own, and she read for her own pleasure, and she became, you know, that kind of reader, as you say, very much in love with reading. When she was in the first grade, inadvertently, we were sent her achievement test. She was at the 99.9 percentile in reading ability.
Wow, and that's great. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact of loving it, of seeing it as a positive. I think we have too many, you know, children now that don't read because it's too easy to get our information visually by watching television or something like that. I know that I worked as a room dad in the classroom with some of the kids when my kids were younger, and many of the kids, as you know, we would ask them to read certain things and then report on it, and it would be, well, isn't there a movie about it that we can see instead, you know? I think in many kids the concept of not feeling like that there's a need to read, or that they don't learn to love to read, where they can still use their imagination, I think is a great loss when that happens.
Well, I think your analysis is perfect.
Well,
is right on. I'm totally in agreement with it.
Well, thank you. Now,
a study that was reported, in the media just a week or two ago, tells us something along those lines that we're talking about now. And the study has it that middle-class parents talk to their children, say words to their children a huge number of times and a greater amount than children of poor parents. And what that really means is that children in middle-class families become much more flexible, much more more advanced in their language skills than children in, you know, this is in general, than children in poor families do. That means that, and this is what they find, that means that the middle-class children are going to do better in school right from the beginning than the poor children do. That's a real problem. That's a problem in our society. It's one that we really should be working on to correct.
Well, I couldn't agree more. We're going to take a break. We will be right back. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to us on Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. We are talking about the marvelous learning animal, what makes human nature unique. Our guest, Dr. Arthur W. Stotz, is in Hawaii. I would imagine he's probably sitting there in a beautiful sky, enjoying life and sharing with us quite a bit about human nature and why we do some of the things we do. Now, we're getting some email and instant messages coming in, and at least these seem to touch on dyslexia. So, Arthur, if it's okay, I've got a few questions that have come in for you. The first one reads, my mother and brother are both dyslexic. I have heard varying opinions about this being an inherited trait. Do you believe this is true or not?
Actually, I don't believe it is true, and let me indicate to you what I think happens with children who are dyslexic. I think something that is very general, and it occurs more frequently with boys than it does with girls, and that is if you have a boy who's very used to physical activities and who is... his background has led him to do physical things and have a lot of fun by, games of various kinds, and then goes to school. And let's say this boy hasn't really been trained to follow instructions, to attend to things that are not really pleasing, mm-hmm. that in themselves don't have attractions. That little boy is not going to attend very well when the teacher is presenting things that will teach him to read. He'll be fooling around. He'll be trying to do other things. He'll, be trying to entertain himself in various ways. That child will not learn to read very well. And what happens is once the child doesn't do well, then the situation is set up for the child to continue not to do well. The child who's doing well and is learning what the teacher says and maybe already has some of the skills gets a lot of rewards for what they do. The mm-hmm. the other child gets nothing and stops paying attention even more.
Well, and I think you're touching on a subject. I know that John Maxwell has also touched on this subject in saying that if we would focus on what it is that each child does well, rather than focusing on what it is that they don't do well, we would have a lot more of really incredibly great achievers. that we need to keep our focus. I'm just saying, I think what you're saying kind of synergizes with what John Maxwell says, that if we can just focus on those things that they do well, they're going to enjoy and thrive more on those things because they're already doing it well, which means they feel good about it because they get the positive reinforcement from doing it well. So,
I think that's very good. I would certainly agree with that. I do think that with respect to reading, we have some things that can be done that are very particular and very specific and will take the child out of their dyslexia. Can I describe a little bit about that?
You know what? I would love you to, but hang on, because I think what you're about to tell us also answers this other question that has just come in. So I think we can take care of both. This one reads, it says, I notice the emphasis on preventing dyslexia in children. As a person who has suffered with this all of my life, is there anything that teens and adults can do to overcome the condition? There we go.
Yes, I would say, you know, what sometimes happens in dyslexia is, the person doesn't learn the basic elements of reading like other children do. You know, other children, for example, will start by learning all the letters of the alphabet and be able to name them, be able to write them, and distinguish all of them very well. Whereas a dyslexic person may actually learn to read at a later stage where they only work words and word phrases, but they don't really have that discrimination of the letters. And so they may make mistakes on things where there's just a little letter difference. A person who's dyslexic really has to learn all of the different repertoires that are involved in reading, including the discrimination of all the letters of the alphabet, and that's very easy to do if it's conducted properly. The dyslexic person has to learn to read syllables, and to know all the syllables, and then the dyslexic person has to learn to read the words, word phrases, and do it a lot. In other words, do a great deal of reading.
Okay.
Ultimately, if the dyslexic person will go through those various steps, their reading skills will improve greatly.
Now, are those steps also explained in?
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me? I was going to say, are those steps explained in the book, The Marvelous Learning Animal?
Actually, they're explained in my, I have, as we talked about at the beginning, I have more than one book, and there are better accounts in some books than in other books. Probably not as in detail in the book that I'm talking about, but enough in detail so that it will be helpful to that person.
Okay, and
may I say something?
Please do. But what I was going to say is also share with us, you know, the different places where the book can be for anybody that's listening to this and saying, okay, that sounds like something that I need to learn more about. Share with us where they can find the book.
Yes. Well, you know, Amazon, and Amazon has it in Kindle, and Amazon has it in hardback.
Okay.
Also, Barnes & Noble has it. Barnes & Noble has it in Nook, and there are many different companies that sell it.
That's great.
If one goes online, one will see. You know, one can establish that.
Okay,
one can see that.
And then let me do this. I'm going to spell your last name. So if anybody wants to go on and Google, if you want to look at some of his other books, maybe the best way would be, again, it's Arthur W. And the last name is spelled S-T-A-A-T-S. So if you Google that up, that may give you a list of some of the other books, you know, that you may find helpful as well. So, and let me just share. I'm looking at, and we're doing okay on time. We've got another question, or actually more of a statement. And this one says,
okay.
This one says, this is an incredibly exciting show. As a second grade teacher, I am thrilled to know there are possible solutions. In a class of 25, I have four that have been diagnosed with dyslexia. It is very damaging to their self-esteem, not to mention their incentive to participate in class. I will be buying your book immediately to learn more about what I can do in the classroom, as well as recommend to parents of those students.
So, can I say something?
Please do.
We have a series of studies done in schools with children who have had difficulty learning to read. And in one, which was conducted in Milwaukee in the central area, we had a number of children who came from culturally deprived homes and who were non-readers. And these were children who were already 13, 14 years old. And what we did was, during the school day, they would, it was after school, they would go in for a half-hour training session. And it was a training session in which they were rewarded. They were it was a program where they were shown words, and if they could read them, they got a reward. If they couldn't read them, they were told what the name of it was, and then they got a reward. And anyhow, they learned single words, and then they learned to read them in passages, and then they learned to read them in stories. And but they were rewarded. They were rewarded for what they did, with minimal reward, actually. But they picked out what they wanted to work for. It could be a baseball glove. It could be a ticket to a movie, or it could be something like that. And when they got tokens for that, and those children all participated voluntarily, they learned a great deal. Their IQs went up. Their reading achievement scores went up. If a dyslexic child can be introduced to a situation where they are where they receive training in reading and they're rewarded for it, they can learn and learn to the point where they become normal in their reading. I have the other studies have been done using my kinds of methods in which that is the outcome.
I think that's great. Now, we've got about five more minutes, and I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that you touch on in chapter 6 and 7, where you go into the marvelous learning of personality, and I think in this day and age, that is so important. And if you can share with us a little bit about how much of personality is learned.
You know, at the beginning we talked about these repertoires like language and numbers, and those are repertoires. Personality is actually a complex of what has their repertoires that the individuals learn. They could be friendliness, they can be, you know, diligence, they can be honesty, they can, you know, those are. Well, those things are all involve repertoires of learned behaviors. And so they're learned in the same way that the others are, but they're built upon. For example, here's the best example I can give you is intelligence. Intelligence is a part of personality. And if you analyze what intelligence consists of, if you go back on the intelligence test, you'll find that at ages 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, they're largely testing language. They're testing the child's language development. They're testing whether they know beginning number concepts. They're testing the kinds. That's what intelligence consists of. A child who's had the benefit of a fortunate learning experience and has acquired those repertoires is intelligent, has an intelligent personality. And so maybe I can stop there. But before I stop, let me say this. We have shown that this is the case. We have taken children and in our kind of training situation, trained them to read and write the letters, and they go up in intelligence when they learn that repertoire. That's published in the scientific journal. So does that sort of answer your question?
Yeah, but it sounds like what you're talking about, and I know that Daniel Goldman writes a lot about this, which is emotional intelligence. Is that kind of what you're saying? Is that, you know, there's more than just the, you know, the basic IQ type intelligence, but there's also the emotional intelligence that we have.
Yes, sir. There are various kinds of things that we could call intelligence. For example, there are developmental tests for children that test their sensory motor skills, those are skills that are important too. There are emotional skills or social skills, how to respond to people in various ways, and those are you know, call them what you will. They are developments of a repertoire that's very important for the child's adjustment in life. And so, yes, emotional intelligence, emotional skills are definitely important.
Okay. Now, what are the, you know, obviously, you know, if we're going to talk about the personality, there's also the abnormal personality.
Yes.
So on the one hand, I'm not one that wants to paint labels on things, but sometimes as a talking point, what are some of the things that maybe from a learning standpoint are happening different that we're ending up with maybe somebody that falls into that category of more of an abnormal personality?
Yes. Well, abnormal personality consists of two things, I'll say quickly, and that is a child can learn abnormal behaviors, like temper tantrums, or getting things that the child wants, versus learning language to request it, and so that's one thing, a child can learn abnormal behaviors, and we can see how, I've seen how that happens. A child can also not learn things that are necessary for adjustment in life. And that's part of, for example, an autistic child has both kinds. An autistic child has learned abnormal behaviors. And an autistic child has not learned some important normal behaviors. Severely autistic children have not learned language. They have not had the experiences that we have been talking about. And an autistic child can have learned, and an autistic child, by the way, will not many times have learned to love the parents and have a positive emotional response toward them. But an autistic child will also learn abnormal behaviors, temper tantrums, and various head banging against the wall and sitting there and doing repetitive behaviors, playing with water. And the child learns that in the same way, according to the same principles as other children are learning the things that they should learn. I would say that, yes.
Okay. Well,
you know, that's a very hurried, and you, a person who's really interested in that should read my book.
Yeah,
because,
that
will give that a much firmer presentation. Can I say one thing?
Please do.
and that's this. With all the belief we have that the child displays whatever they display, the personality, their various skills of various kinds, they display it because their brain is pre-wired that way. And I'm saying a different thing, that the child learns these things. Let me ask this. What okay. can a parent do who's told that their child's brain wiring is wrong? Nothing. What can anyone do who has a child who's dyslexic and is told that it's because their brain is different in some way? There's nothing you can do that way. What can you do if a child doesn't develop language? You can't flip their brain. You can't give them an electric shock. But you can do things that of a learning sort can work on all of those cases. And so I guess I should stop.
No, I think that's a great place for us to end on. Know that there are things that you can do. There are things that can be learned. Don't sit back on an excuse of, oh, well, that's just the way that they are, and do nothing.
Wonderful.
What I hear you saying is there are lots of things that you can do. Keep it positive, but know that there are things that you can do. So, Arthur, thank you so much. Again, for those of you out there, his latest book, The Marvelous Learning Animal, What Makes Human Nature Unique. Arthur, thank you so much. And for everybody else out there, thank you for listening. If you want to get more information, we will have it on our website. If you go to thefamilyblog.com, we'll have all the information you need on Arthur and his book. Arthur, have a great week.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.